Good morning. It is time to get up with one NBA superstar who wants to sit down if his team can't win at all. Is he alone? And is he right? Then, Tua, should he take a seat for an entire season? Why are they talking so much about him playing as soon as it's possible? And then, Michael Jordan, on tape, says exactly what we thought once and for all actually happened with Isaiah Thomas and the Dream Team. You'll hear it as we get up with you on ESPN on a Wednesday from Bristol. I'm Mike Greenberg, delighted you have chosen to get up with us, and we are jam-packed today. Doris Burke is standing by, ready to go with tons of insight on a very big day for basketball. But let's start with get up and go and race all around the world of sports. And we start with this. In their first economic proposal to the players, Major League Baseball is asking the higher-salaried players to take significant pay cuts off their already prorated salaries, while the lower-paid players would still have to take smaller pay reductions. This was met with great disappointment from the players yesterday, and candidly, both sides are being very public about their issues. Here's the breakdown, and Jeff Passan's going to be with us in our next hour. A player making the league minimum of $563,000, based on 82 games would have it prorated, then an additional 10% pay cut. You see the numbers on your screen. That player would wind up at a much lower number. A player making $30 million would be asked to take an additional 50% pay cut after already getting down to the prorated figure. Again, we will get deeply into what this means in an hour with Jeff Passan. Elsewhere, New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy lifted restrictions yesterday on professional sports in that state, setting the stage for, among other things, the Giants and the Jets to be able to host training camps at their facilities this summer. So we'll keep an eye on it. NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman announcing yesterday the league will forego the remainder of its regular season and jump straight into a 24-team playoff if they're able to resume this summer. Postseason games are expected to be played in two hub cities, with one for each conference. They've not named the cities yet. Five rounds would be the structure of the playoff format. The qualifying round would see teams 5 through 12 facing off in best-of-five series for the right to advance. The top four teams would play a round-robin for seeding. The first and second rounds are still being worked on regarding the format or the length of the series, but once down to the final four, the Stanley Cup final as well as the conference finals will be best of seven. They are working towards a return. So is the NBA, still working through various potential scenarios for what the season will look like if and when it's able to resume. But All-Star Damian Lillard, whose Portland Trailblazers currently sit 3.5 games out of the final Western Conference playoff spot, had very interesting comments to Yahoo Sports yesterday. He said, if we come back and they're just like, we're adding a few games to finish the regular season, and they're throwing us out there for meaningless games, and we don't have a true opportunity to get into the playoffs, I'm going to be with my team because I'm a part of the team. But I'm not going to be participating, I'm telling you that, right now. That certainly raised a lot of eyebrows. And we start this morning with Woj, Adrian Wojnarowski. Woj, those sentiments from Dame Lillard, have you heard similar thoughts from other players around the league?
Absolutely, Greeny, but more importantly, so is Adam Silver, and he's known that for months. And so as they construct a return to play here and a playoff structure, that's going to be taken into consideration. They want, if they're going to return, they want to keep players on the court. And to do that, they've got to create a scenario here where a team like Portland, who's only 3.5 games back from the eighth seed in the West, along with a couple other teams, that they'll have an ability to get to the playoffs. And whether that's in a play-in tournament or a pool play scenario, in addition to regular season games, that's going to be a motivator for teams to put their key players back on the floor.
Yeah, so obviously there are a lot of moving pieces there. We'll do a little more on the Damian Lillard piece in a moment. But first, help us here. What are the next steps the NBA needs to take to return?
Well, Adam Silver and the Players Association are drilling down this week into the details of what the structure is going to look like. How many regular season games, how many teams are going to be asked to return, and then what's the pathway to into the playoffs for those teams. There's a Board of Governors meeting on Friday afternoon, Greeny, and that's going to be an opportunity for the owners and Adam Silver to go through the details of a potential plan or move closer to finalizing a potential plan. And so, you know, I think there's some answers coming here by the end of the week for how an NBA return is going to look.
Here we are on the other side of Memorial Day, and we are really working toward the return, it feels like, of all of the major sports for some play this summer. Woj, outstanding. Thank you. And now I want to bring in the rest of my crew this morning, and I don't mean to sound unexcited to have Dominique Foxworth and Dan Orlovsky with me today, because they are always delightful. But when you get Doris Burke, you know things are going to go up a notch. So we are thrilled to have Doris with us this morning. And Doris, I want to start with you. When you hear Damian Lillard say, if we come back and we don't have a legit path to the postseason, he doesn't want to play, what's your reaction to that?
Well, it stands in stark contrast to the thoughts coming out of Golden State, where they say, listen, we're going to be good soldiers no matter what. But if you know Damian Lillard, he is going to speak his truth quietly and clearly. And if you know their history, it suggests that he obviously, with his coaching staff and the experience they have and the potential for Yusuf Nurkic to return and perhaps Zach Collins, their history suggests they could get into a playoff. And so to ask him to come back, to ramp up and prepare all that's required to be ready for an NBA game, to have no meaningful, real competitive opportunity to get into the playoffs, I believe he has a valid point, Greeny.
It's an interesting thought, because I could spin it in so many different directions. Are teams like Golden State, who you just pointed out, or others who are at the bottom who don't have any chance anyway, if they're asked to come back, would you expect their players to say, listen, we don't have anything to play for, so why would we bother? Doris, would those be similar to you?
Listen, Greeny, from the moment talk of restarting this season began to up until yesterday, my thought has been, if the standard of safety is the first and primary thing, then it should be the 16 teams that have earned their way through 75 to 80% of games played. I don't believe under any circumstance that we should be exposing more people than is necessary to this virus. The virus is not done with us yet. So I don't even like the idea. And listen, I say that knowing I had a conversation with Steph Curry, and very casually he said to me, I am trying to wrap my mind around the idea that I may not play NBA basketball until late 2020 or perhaps 2021. So the idea of not seeing Steph, of not seeing Damian, not seeing Trae Young. Yes, it's difficult for all of us, but let's keep the main thing the main thing. Let's establish a standard of safety, acknowledging some inherent risk, and let's get some resolution to the season.
All right, that's well said, because there are two separate pieces to this. And obviously, if the safety and health of everyone cannot be as close to assured as is reasonably possible now, then there'd be no point in talking about any of the rest of this. Anyway, Dominique Foxworth, I'm just curious from the perspective of an athlete. We hear all the time about love of the game. I just want to come back because I just want to play. I want to be out there. And then there's also the notion maybe of some civic responsibility that people, athletes, could feel right now to provide some entertainment for people who are so starving for it. What is your perspective, Neek, on what Damian Lillard said?
Well, Damian's not saying that he won't allow basketball to be played. He said he won't show up. I think he is being a team leader. He's assuring that his guys have sacrificed and committed to this season, that they're not going to get ripped off just because everyone is in a rush to have a game. So I think this is an extension of him, of his on-court leadership. And this is the same example of like a coach trying to work the refs. Like, he is doing the same thing by going public with this. He's putting public pressure on Adam Silver and everyone to make sure that his team doesn't get shortchanged. And he knows that he's going to receive some backlash for it. Frankly, I love it. And I think the people in Portland should appreciate that they have a guy like Damian Lillard that's going to step out there and take the slings and arrows to make sure that everyone who is on his team is looking at it, that he is looking out for everybody who's on his team, because he doesn't care necessarily about Golden State or anybody else. He cares about his guys, and he wants his guys to feel like they're not getting ripped off. And if he has to make threats to do that, then I'm fine with it. That's called being a team leader. It's not always pretty. It's not always easy.
That's an interesting take. That's actually a way of looking at it I hadn't thought of. If that actually is his strategy, it would change my mind. Dan Orlovsky, what do you think?
Yeah, first of all, I think Doris and Dom bring up some outstanding points. And I'm sitting here kind of teetering back and forth, but I wanted to bring a different kind of vantage point to it. If what we've experienced as a group of people over the last 3 months has taught us anything, that there is no such thing as meaningless anymore. Like, we can't take things for granted anymore. And there's a difference between have to and get to. And Dame Lillard would have the opportunity to get to play basketball again. Because there's people out there that have to go do things. Frontline workers and nurses and doctors, they have to go to work. And they have to work more hours and get paid less because of what we're dealing with. Moms have to go to work and be teachers and be mothers. They have to go do that. Kids at the grocery store. I went shopping yesterday at Stu Leonard's here in Westport. There's 16-year-old cashiers that have to go to work so people like myself can go buy food. Dame Lillard would have the opportunity to get to play basketball again. And I would hope and challenge him in his mindset that the last few months has changed that and that he would take the opportunity to go and perform and go and compete and get the opportunity to play basketball again, because some people don't have a choice anymore. They have to go do things. It is not an option. And so while I think Doris and Dom bring up some great points, I struggle with sitting there going, how can you sit there and go, nope, I'm not going to play, but understand that there's people out there that don't have that choice, that they have to go to work and they have to go earn their money. I struggle with sitting here and going, you don't come off as a spoiled and entitled brat by saying, I'm not going to play.
Go ahead, Nick.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of an absurd analogy because the people that have to do it is because they have to do it. Like, we have to eat. No one has to play basketball. We don't have to watch basketball. So I'm not even going to dive into that necessarily. I think what Dame is doing in this situation is fine. He's going to show up. If I were him, I wouldn't even show up. Why go there? To Doris's point, there's no point in exposing yourself to this risk if you don't even have a chance. Like, what are you playing for? What are you exposing yourself and your family to this virus if you don't have any reason to play? So, like, I understand your point. It's terrible that some people have no choice in this matter, but that doesn't mean Dame Lillard has to play basketball. That's an odd leap to say someone has to go deliver our packages, so Dame Lillard, you better play basketball. It just doesn't seem to connect to me necessarily. I like what he's doing, because he's defending the people that he cares about and that care about him and that rely on him, his teammates.
Then say that, Dom. Then say that. If Dame Lillard had come out and said, I don't want to expose myself, or I don't want to, you know, I don't want to expose potentially bringing this to my family, that's a different conversation. But all he's saying is, I don't want to play because I don't have a chance to win a championship. And like I said, you and Doris brought up great points. But then say that. If that's Dame Lillard's reasoning, I'm 100% behind that. And I totally get that and respect that. But don't say, I'm not going to play strictly because I don't have the chance to win the trophy.
Let me give Doris the last word. Go ahead, Doris.
There are monumental challenges here for any sport that wants to return. The fact of the matter is Damian Lillard has lost somebody close to him in his immediate inner circle in the last month or so. He also has a young son. All of these professional athletes, like the rest of us, have family that we worry and are concerned about. These are monumental challenges. It is why I have said, if there is a return for the NBA, let's go to the 16 teams. Let's establish some standard of safety that gives us the best chance to minimize risk. Because I do believe, Greeny, that like other businesses, people are getting hammered, sports leagues, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't matter. Life and death matters. And that should be our primary concern here.
This is a conversation that we are not done with by any means this morning, guys. Outstanding. Stay with me. We're just getting rolling on Get Up this morning. Still to come, we will tell you what Lamar Jackson will not do this season and why the Cowboys need to be very worried about Tom Brady. Bold predictions are on the way. And then, before The Last Dance premiered, Michael Jordan talked about his concern for how people might view him when it was done. Are those fears being realized right now? That answer on the way. Get Up on ESPN.
It's your home speaking, and I need you to do me a couple of favors. First, could you get that blueberry that rolled under the fridge last week? It's throwing my feng shui off. Second thing, bundle your home and car insurance with GEICO. It's easy, and we could save money. Lastly, I know you were thinking of painting the nursery back to off-white, but I'm actually feeling this baby blue. Didn't think it was my color, but I am pulling it off.
GEICO. For bundling made easy, go to geico.com today.
Foot odor throwing you off your game? Stick to a winning game plan with Odor Eaters, featuring 3 advanced odor and wetness fighters. The lineup provides long-lasting odor control plus more to keep your feet on their game.
Odor Eaters powder provides outstanding moisture control. Clear drying spray is the MVP in preventing athlete's foot, while insoles work continuously to manage wetness while adding a layer of comfort. Pick up today at Walmart, Target, CVS, Dollar General, or other fine retailers.
Odor Eaters. Destroy foot odor with the best in odor defense.
Get Up is brought to you by Burger King. 8 spicy chicken nuggets for just $1. Well, he spent a lot of yesterday talking about FPI, the Football Power Index, our analytics, and all the projections they released. Dan Orlovsky, you've got some stuff to react to here with you this morning. The Ravens are a favorite in every game. Do you agree?
I don't, Greeny. Listen, the Ravens are going to be great. But why is everyone sleeping on the Pittsburgh Steelers? Here's the reality. The Ravens, you can make the case, are losing one of, if not their best player. Not the most electric player, Lamar Jackson, but their offensive guard, or Marshall Yanda, who retired. And the Pittsburgh Steelers are getting their best player back in Ben Roethlisberger. That's going to be a brutal division, and I could absolutely see the Pittsburgh Steelers winning it.
How about a different division? FPI views the AFC East as a coin flip. Buffalo, New England. Who you got?
This is not a coin flip. This is Buffalo. This is Buffalo's division by a long shot. They've gotten better as a football team this offseason. They were a playoff football team last year, and they were 3-3 in that division. Both losses to the Patriots and a loss in the last game of the year against the Jets where they sat everyone. The Bills should run away with this division considering it's a top five defense and an offense that added Stephon Diggs and is absolutely up and coming.
We'll talk more about that division in 10 minutes. Meanwhile, FPI likes Dallas, giving the Cowboys a better chance to reach the Super Bowl than Tom Brady's Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Do you agree?
Not at all. The Buccaneers are a much better football team. Where are the Cowboys better as a football team? You can make the case running back. That's not an argument. An offensive line. But the Buccaneers are a better team at quarterback. They're at worst equal at wide receiver. They're a better defensive line. They're as good as the linebacking core, and the secondaries are probably comparable. But at the most important position, the Buccaneers are healthier. And they were a 7-9 team last year with everything that went on with that football team. They're a much more complete, reliable, and deep football team than the Dallas Cowboys are.
I agree. They're in a much tougher division, but I sincerely agree they're a better team. I want to bring Orlovsky back, and I want to bring Dan Graziano into the conversation, and I'll just say it because I know everyone else is thinking it. Dan Graziano and Dominic Foxworth are wearing the same jacket today.
I saw that. His looks nicer. But I saw it. Good thing we're not in the studio sitting next to each other was my first thought.
Our mom dressed us alike for Easter pictures later this afternoon.
It just felt like it needed to be said.
Y'all look cute. You guys look like multiple kids.
Now that it's been said, Neek, who's a better football team? Your beloved Dak Prescott's Dallas Cowboys or Tom Brady's Buccaneers?
Yeah, I mean, I think on paper, the Buccaneers, I think Dan's right. The Bucs are more complete team on paper. However, you don't win games on paper. So I think the question marks around the Bucs, if they're able to put it all together and figure it all out, I think is why they are behind them. But I think it's just by like 1%. Like, it's not a lot.
How about you? What do you think, Graziano? Who's a better football team? Who's a better chance to make it to the Super Bowl is really what the question is. Bucs or Cowboys?
Yeah, I have to say Cowboys. I'm a guy that has to see it first. I know Dan gets excited. I remember last summer he had the Browns winning 12 games. They looked great on paper. It's exciting to think about what the Buccaneers can be. But the Buccaneers and the Cowboys are not comparable franchises right now. The Cowboys haven't had a losing season since 2015. That's the only losing season they've had in the last 9 years. The Bucs haven't had a winning season since 2016. That's the only winning season they've had in the last 9 years.
Bryce.
I've got to see the Tampa Bay Buccaneers
gang.
Win
Plum
before
Coat
I believe
gang. Get them grass.
That the Tampa Bay Buccaneers are winners. And by the way, you talk about division, the Cowboys have to overcome the Eagles, who've won 18 games the last 2 years. The Buccaneers have to overcome the Saints, who have won 26 games the last 2 years. So I think there's a significant difference in terms of what the teams need to accomplish in order to even reach the playoffs.
Can I tell you how sneaky good Graziano is? Because here's what the audience doesn't know, but you're about to, because I'm going to tell you. That while he was taking his shots at Orlovsky, the producer was saying, got to be quick here, guys. We're going to need to get to a break. So he knows that Orlovsky is not going to get a chance to fire
well
back
done.
At him. So that's TV 101
and
there.
I'm going
get your comments in
coat
at exactly the time that I will then have to say, let's run the hurry up with Dan Graziano and run through a bunch of other storylines here. Dan, the Tom Brady era is over in New England. What is their plan at quarterback?
As of now, the starter would be Jarrett Stidham. That is their ideal plan. But you remember, they did bring in Brian Hoyer, who has been there multiple times before, who knows the system, who knows Josh McDaniels. If they can't get Jarrett Stidham ready, if something happens to him physically, the Patriots believe they could put Brian Hoyer in, and he could start and win games for them, given how good their defense is.
Next, what role will Jordan Love have with the Packers this year?
I believe his role this year will be to watch and learn. I know there was some discussion, some questions asked last week about would Jordan Love have a role in the offense this year. I personally believe, based on the conversations I've had there, that that is far-fetched. Obviously, we've talked ad nauseum about how this is going to be a tricky situation to manage with Aaron Rodgers and Jordan Love. I don't think putting Jordan Love on the field in year one makes a lot of sense because, A, that's a complicated offense to learn in the first place, and, B, what would it bring in terms of the Rodgers situation?
And then how about this guy, Jalen Hurts? How will the Eagles use him this year?
Yeah, I think the Eagles would really like to have a Jalen Hurts package where it looks a little bit like what the Saints do with Taysom Hill. Where they keep Nate Sudfeld active as the backup because they feel like he could step in if Carson Wentz got hurt. But Hurts can actually do some things for them this year. That'll develop as the summer goes along, and if they have a training camp, we'll see. But I think in the Eagles' ideal world, they would find a place for Jalen Hurts in his rookie year.
Dan Graziano, all around the NFL. We'll see if Orlovsky gets a shot at firing back at you as we continue. Meanwhile, Michael Jordan openly worried about his reputation before Last Dance. Coming up next, you'll find out why one part of the documentary is still making news and raising questions about his airness. But first, a little sneaky hembo for Orlovsky, who's just getting fired on by everybody today. Here you go, Dan. Here's the question with Tua in the news. Who is the last left-handed quarterback to start an NFL game? Orlovsky's up. We'll answer that question next. You're watching Get Up on ESPN. I like that jacket, Nate.
GEICO has the insurance industry leading app that lets you manage your policy anytime, anywhere, which means that GEICO is always there for you. If only everyone was always there for you. Like animal control, when you're cornered in your garage by an angry possum.
Hi, me again. You guys said you would be here about an hour ago, and I think the possum is starting to get angry. Listen, I thought if I fed it, it would go away, but now it is ripping holes in the drywall and making some sort of nest. Just call me back.
GEICO, always there for you with savings and the industry-leading mobile app.
We are back on Get Up, and Orlovsky, here we go. Hembo's coming for you today. We're going to talk about Tua in a minute. Who is the last left-handed quarterback to start an NFL game?
I'm going to dunk on Hembo like I was about to dunk on Graziano. It's my boy. It's the offensive coordinator for the Dallas Cowboys, Kellen Moore.
That's exactly right. He is known by Rex Ryan as the Boy Wonder. He started week 17 of the 2015 season for the Cowboys. Kellen Moore, the last left-hander. Well done. Meanwhile, Orlovsky, here's what I've been reading for you. You were away for a couple of days last week. So all four teams in the AFC East have young quarterbacks they plan to build around. If you were drafting amongst the four of them right now, in what order would they go? We'll start at number four of the four young quarterbacks. So it's Stidham and it's Allen and it's Darnold and it's Tua. Who would be the fourth pick out of those four?
Yeah, it would be Jarrett Stidham. I think there's a lot to like about Jarrett Stidham, or intrigued by his understanding of pocket awareness. He's very good in the pocket, and he works the ball between the numbers really well, which is something New England likes to do. But that's a team that is very much in reset mode. Their skill position is not great, and there's the unknown about Jarrett Stidham, that as a fourth-round pick, you got to go prove it. So I have to go. I want to see Jarrett Stidham go out and go do it, especially with the people that are around him. That's why he's at number four. For number three would be Josh Allen. And Josh Allen's a guy that his career trajectory right now is on the uptick. But I got to see him go over 60% completion percentage, throw for over 3,500 yards or more than 20 touchdowns. He's becoming a guy that you go, man, we could win a lot of football games with. And they've got a really good roster around him. And Brian Daboll, his offensive coordinator, has got a really good understanding but I want to see him increase some of those things. Number two, I would put Tua Tagovailoa. I love Tua's game. I think his strengths are the absolute necessities at the quarterback position. Can you think really fast? And can you place the ball in a 4-inch by 4-inch box, meaning NFL type of accuracy? They've got some good young players in Miami with Devontae Parker and Mike Gesicki. And I think that that organization is settling in to be something that we've got our general manager and head coach. So that's really good. But number one is in, it's not in close, Green. I'm taking Sam Darnold. And everyone should know that by now. Sam Darnold last year got mono. And then from week 10 on, he was 6-2 as a quarterback. And he was top 10 in touchdown passes. He was top 10 in passer rating. He was top 10 in yards per completion. The kid is going to be a special player. And it seems that the Jets finally are starting to build around him. Finally starting to understand that if we protect him and give him a couple pieces, this guy can be our version of Ben Roethlisberger. And that's why, for me, Sam Darnold is the clear favorite in that division for the guy that I would want as a draft moving forward.
It's hard to be confident in a guy when every time someone is trying to make the case for him, they start talking about how he got sick. Like he had mono. That is, we're back to the old chicken pox makes you great argument. That is not going to help. I just don't get it.
And now you see, Orlovsky, what I had to put up.
I told you why he was great.
You had to see what I had to put up with last week. So Hasselbeck and Neek are making fun of me for bringing up the same thing. When obviously, Neek, the point is that the jump that a young quarterback is supposed to make in his second year was significantly impacted by the fact that he was sick with a kind of illness that it's not like a knee or something like that. It was something that sapped all of his energy. He looked terrible week one. We all worried about it. Then we found out it's because he had mono. And then when he got healthy and was himself again, he played a lot better with terrible skill position players. Terrible. I mean, Tom Brady was looking at the Jets skill position players and saying, well, thank God I'm not playing with that. So if they make that a little better, the offensive line was terrible, that gets better. Magical sloppiness, Dan, that's your phrase, and I love it.
Greeny, let me put it this way, and Dom, hopefully, you know, this makes some sense. Last year, when the Jets had Sam Darnold as their starting quarterback, they were a winning football team. When the Jets did not have Sam Darnold as their starting quarterback, they were 0-3, and they scored one offensive touchdown. I mean, that is the exact definition of difference maker. And right. Mind you, Dom, that's with the bottom five offensive line in both run game and pass game. And that's with bottom five skill position players. Like, it's...
Yeah,
this,
you're right.
He has the ability to be a great player.
I have no argument with you about how good Sam Darnold has the ability to be. He does have a turnover problem that goes all the way back to college, his interception problem. But I agree that Sam Darnold is good. But if we're talking about who's going to be the best quarterback going forward, I think that the skills that Tua has shown that he has, like, it's all potential. We haven't seen him do it on the field. I think that's more intriguing to me, especially in an organization that it feels like is more on the right track than anybody can say the Jets have been in recent history.
Fair. Let me jump in here. Because I could talk about Sam Darnold all day, but I'm envisioning right now all our friends in the hashtag Bills Mafia saying, hey, guys, you realize Josh Allen has accomplished more in terms of winning and losing. He led his team to the playoffs and all of that. And while, yes, his completion percentage isn't good, he does it a little bit of a different way. And we're seeing others do that successfully. Why, Dan Orlovsky, is he third on this list?
And I would agree with a lot of Bills Mafia. I would be very cautious when you have a top five defense as a quarterback going, hey, this guy won a bunch of football games. You know, like, you know, when you have a top five defense, you should win a bunch of football games as a starting quarterback. Like I said, I want to see him get over 60% completion percentage. He's never going to be the 68, 69% guy that's deadly accurate, nor should they ask him to. And I want to see him go over 3,500 yards passing. He's not done that. I got to see more than 20 touchdown passes. There is the potential there with Josh Allen. And again, he is on this uptick. That's why people who say this is a make or break year, it's not. He's going to have a good season. Ben Roethlisberger in his third year threw 18 touchdowns and 23 picks. It's not a make or break year for Josh Allen, but Tua has things in his game, both in pocket movement, understanding, and accuracy that Josh doesn't. And Sam Darnold has his things in his game where he can make throws that you just cannot coach that Josh Allen doesn't.
I'm not afraid of the Bills Mafia. I make a habit of disagreeing with people that suplex each other through tables, and also people like Dan who dab in the middle of segments 5 years after anyone is still dabbing. You all have bad judgment. Josh Allen is way down on this list.
We're bringing it back.
He's getting
better.
We're bringing
it back.
No, we're not. No, we're not.
All right, let's leave that there for the moment. I really just wanted to go back to that because I knew Orlovsky would pick my guy. But let's get to what I think is one of the most interesting things that happened yesterday. It sets up with this. In The Last Dance, Michael Jordan, you saw it, said he had nothing to do with Hall of Famer Isaiah Thomas not making the Dream Team back in 92 for the Barcelona Olympics. However, in a recording from a podcast in 2011 that has now resurfaced, Jordan said this.
Rob didn't call me. He said, Rob, I won't play with Isaiah Thomas on the team. He assured me, he said, you know what? Chuck that one, Isaiah. So Isaiah's not going to be a part of the team.
Okay. So that seems to be in stark contrast to what we heard from Michael during the Last Dance. I want to play two other sound bites for you here. The first one you'll hear is from Rod Thorne, who was in charge of the selection committee. And you just heard Michael referencing him. He was on Golic and Wingo last month. Then you'll hear Isaiah Thomas on our show last month talking about how much all of this bothered him. Let's play those.
There was never anything in my conversation with him that had to do with Isaiah Thomas. Period. He said, I'll do it.
If I'm not a part of the Dream Team because, you know, a lapse in emotion in terms of not shaking someone's hand, if that's the reason why I didn't make the Dream Team, then I am more disappointed today than I was back then when I wasn't selected.
And Isaiah was really striking that day with how much that still eats at him to this day. And the bad blood between Michael and Isaiah really dates all the way back to Michael's rookie year when Isaiah Thomas froze him out of the All-Star game in 1984. Doris is back with us. And Doris, here's where I want to pick up the conversation. Michael made an interesting comment before The Last Dance started airing on ESPN. He said that he was worried about the way people would perceive him once they'd seen it. How do you think people should perceive him now that we've seen it, particularly in light of what came out yesterday?
Well, I think there were moments during that documentary where I was uncomfortable. I was uncomfortable for Jerry Krause, for Scottie Pippen, for Isaiah Thomas. And in the immortal words of Ricky Ricardo, somebody's got some splaining to do, because clearly either Michael or Rod Thorne is not telling the complete truth. Here's the fact of the matter. To me, there are more people culpable than just Michael Jordan. He had enormous sway, but there were other decision makers involved, and you can't convince me that the other players on the Dream Team didn't somehow catch wind of this. I was uncomfortable with the documentary. I don't blame Michael Jordan. We are all an amalgamation of our best and worst traits, and obviously, and Nick touched on this, leadership is hard. Leadership is about making people uncomfortable. Results speak for themselves. He is, in many people's minds, the greatest of all time. But typically, genius comes with great genius. Great achievement comes sometimes with great flaws.
That's very well said. Dominique, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I hate that I have to follow that. She summed it up so perfectly. But I do understand what I've never quite gotten is what else did Isaiah do? Because I know how petty everyone thinks Michael Jordan is, and he showed himself to be, and it drove him to be great. But it seems like so many people didn't like Isaiah, and it can't be just because he didn't shake one hand one time. I know Isaiah had issues with going back to his hometown of Chicago and feeling like Michael had taken that city from him. And I know that kind of led to some of the tension at the beginning. But there had to be so much other stuff going on for everyone, including Chuck Daly, the coach of that Dream Team, who also coached that Pistons team, to be comfortable with not bringing his best star to, and the guy who brought him two championships, onto the Dream Team. Like, so it seems to me that there's so much more to this story that no one seems to understand. It got to be more than just not shaking Mike's hand that one time.
It's a good question. I can't speak for Chuck, obviously, and he's no longer with us to speak for himself. What I can say as one who covered the league at that time is the Pistons, in general, were strongly disliked and were thought by many to be a flat-out dirty team. Right. And Isaiah was the leader of that team.
I think he
bore some of that.
I get it, but they still allowed Chuck Daly to be the coach, who was the coach of that team. He's the coach of the All-Star team. Then the Bulls still went on to sign Dennis Rodman, who I saw the clips of him throwing Scottie Pippen into the stands. It just seemed like they're selective. And again, maybe I don't know the whole story, but if the story that's out there is all there is, it seems like they're selective with the people who have to pay the price and how much price they have to pay for something as insignificant and as minor as not shaking someone's hand after a game.
That's fair. Dan Orlovsky, I'm curious to hear. What does your big picture take on Jordan now that we're hearing all this stuff?
Unsurprised. I mean, Michael Jordan was a tornado, and he was going to rip through anything in his path to go achieve what he wanted. So I'm not shocked by that at all. we've learned, we knew Michael Jordan was this maniacal competitor, and we got to certainly people that maybe weren't as old enough to understand in that moment. Through the documentary, we got to see that in a very extreme light. Why would I be surprised that Michael Jordan didn't want a guy on his team that in many ways disrespected him in that moment? It's not like Michael Jordan kicked Isaiah Thomas off the Dream Team right now. He did it in that moment. And so I'm not shocked by it at all. He, like, to get to different destinations, people take different journeys and they're willing to do different things. You may not agree with it. I may not agree with it. People may not agree with the way that he did it, but I'm not surprised that he did that. That's why he was Michael Jordan.
Doris, is that necessary? I'll give you the final thought here. You've been around so many of the great ones, and in particular the guys today. We sometimes, Mark Jackson said it on this show, that the players of that era might have been cut from a slightly different cloth. Do you think we get the same sort of thing today that we had back then?
I do think there are players. Draymond Green comes to mind. He is not opposed to making you uncomfortable. We've seen it play out visually in many circumstances. I talked to Steph Curry about leadership. You know, standing in stark contrast to the way Draymond Green does it, Steph Curry does it differently. I don't know that I'd cross eras and compare people and make those kinds of judgments. I would just say that at that time, that was clearly acceptable to those players. It was interesting to me to listen to his teammates say, "We were afraid of Mike." That's an interesting way to go through a very long 82-game season and beyond if you're advancing as far as they are.
That's a really good point. It's one that I think comes up every now and again with the Patriots. I think the similarities between the Patriots of this era and the Jordan-led Bulls of that era strike me sometimes as remarkable. All right, much more on this as we go. Meanwhile, I will let you know that tonight on ESPN, you can relive one of the really legendary nights in the history of the NBA. It was April 13th of 2016. The first thing you'll see at 7 Eastern tonight was the game Steph Curry and the Warriors won their NBA record 73rd of the season. And then following that, you will see Kobe Bryant's final NBA game in which he scored 60 points in his legendary finale. You'll see it all tonight on ESPN and the ESPN app. Coming up, as college football teams are preparing to return, what kind of pressure are the programs and the conferences under? We've got the answers next. You're watching Get Up on ESPN.
Geico gets you access to licensed agents 24/7, which means that Geico is always there for you. If only everyone was always there for you. Like your mom, when you fill out really, really important paperwork on the first day of a new job.
Name? Check. Birthday? Social security? Is that a thing? Hey, mom, what is my social security number? Mom? 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 Okay, let's guess. 0017. Oh, Gemini. Hashtag. Done.
Geico. Always there for you with savings and 24/7 access to licensed agents.
On a day filled with interesting news from around the world of sports, the Pac-12 yesterday announced that the conference will begin allowing voluntary in-person workouts for all sports starting on June 15th, as long as local governments and universities allow the student athletes to return to campuses. Here's the commissioner, Larry Scott, telling Paul Feinbaum he's hopeful they'll be able to start on time.
We have time, which is an asset in this case. We have till the end of June, early July, I think, before we have to decide if we're moving forward with football training camp as the lead-up on the glide path to the start of the college football season. So I'd say right now I'm cautiously optimistic that not only will all Pac-12 schools, you know, be there, but the whole country together will be up to move forward and start college football on time.
Here's Laura Rutledge with us this morning, and Danny's here as well. Laura, I feel like 2 weeks ago or thereabouts, we were almost writing off the Pac-12 for the season. And here are comments from the commissioner that are diametrically opposed to that. Sort of makes me wonder just how much pressure are people like him under right now to make sure football is played if it can be.
Yeah, I think these conference commissioners, especially the Power Five conference commissioners, are under a lot of pressure. But you're right. A couple of weeks ago, this narrative was completely different around the Pac-12 schools. And I think that's because a lot of people misinterpreted what came out about Cal State schools not having students on campus and just automatically assumed that that included the Pac-12. I had spoken to people affiliated with the Pac-12 at the time who said, well, wait a second. We haven't made any of these decisions and we are still proceeding full force as if we are going to have football in the fall if it's possible. And so I think there was a lot of misinformation around that. And either way, you know, the Pac-12 is entering another unique opportunity here. They absolutely, as it relates to the pressure that you're talking about, do not want to miss out on an opportunity to try and keep up with everybody else around the country as long as it's safe. They've got a great season ahead of them. Keaton Slovis, the USC quarterback, is one I'm really excited about. I think there's a lot of football that they're excited about if they can go ahead and get this thing up and running.
Okay, I want to ask you one other thing, and then, Dan, I'll get you in on that, because Lincoln Riley, the coach of Oklahoma, who joined us on this show not long ago, Laura, has been very vocal and maybe the most cautious high-profile coach that we've heard from. Mm-hmm. But they made an announcement yesterday that I know you thought was very significant. Why was that so important?
Yeah, they announced that they're going to have their student athletes back on campus or allow them to come back for the voluntary workouts and for everything that they have in place July 1st. And, you know, there was a quote in there from Lincoln Riley talking about how important it is to be cautious through all this. He's maintained that as well. But one of the things that really stuck out to me, Greeny, is we've tried to find answers of what exactly happens when a player or a staff member or somebody tests positive for COVID-19. And what Oklahoma said in their statement is that they will have a designated area, a dorm basically on campus where these student athletes that were, you know, would maybe test positive would go, and then they would be treated there with full access to anything that they would need from OU's medical staff. Of course, they outlined all of the precautions they'll be taking from the sanitation standpoint, only having 10 or less people in a weight room at a time. But I just thought this part was very interesting. You can see it on your screen, of saying how they would handle quarantining players that test positive for COVID-19.
So, Dan, it's a reminder that there has to be a plan because there's a risk. And we started the show this morning talking about professional athletes taking that risk. What are your thoughts on collegiates who are not getting paid to do this, taking some sort of risk?
Yeah, we're asking a lot of these college athletes. Now, I'm not a doctor, but it's important to state that everything we know about the data tells us that college kids aren't totally, you know, like, They're some of the safest when it comes to this disease. They're not the most at risk. So that's important for us to understand that. But we're asking a ton of them in regards to that. If I was a parent, or even if I was a player, I'd not only want to know the protocol or the steps for a person who tests positive, but I would want to know how my son is going to be protected from that teammate who was tested positive. I want to know what they're going to do to make sure that, or give him the best chance that he doesn't. And also, I want to know this as a parent. Do I trust that that coach in a pressure situation is going to follow protocol? When we get to a must-win game in college football or potentially the college football playoffs, do I trust that that coach is going to follow the protocol that is set forth and that he will put my son's health at the premium over having him play in that football game?
Ah, you've identified, I think, the big question, and we'll continue to go in search of that. Guys, outstanding. Thank you, Laura. We'll see you on First Take later this morning. Meanwhile, tomorrow night on ESPN, we will look back at the classic college football national championship game from 2003, Ohio State and Miami, in an overtime thriller with a controversial finish. That's tomorrow night, 7 Eastern on ESPN and on the ESPN app. Four Minneapolis police officers have been fired in the death of George Floyd after a video showed one of the officers kneeling on Floyd's neck. Floyd was handcuffed and pleading that he could not breathe. That incident has sparked a public outcry from across the country, including from many high-profile professional athletes, including LeBron James, who weighed in with an Instagram post that you see here. It's a photo of Floyd being held down by the officer alongside a photo of Colin Kaepernick taking a knee. And he wrote, "This is why. Do you understand now, or is it still blurred to you? Hashtag stay woke." Kaepernick, of course, took a knee during the national anthem to protest police brutality. The FBI and state law enforcement are investigating. The police department is conducting an internal investigation. They will no doubt be talking more about that later this morning here on ESPN on First Take. That follows us today at 10 o'clock Eastern Time. And then the regular full day of sports news here, followed by SportsCenter, NFL Live, and The Jump. At 4 o'clock, you have 20 minutes of Jalen and Jacoby, highly questionable, and around the horn. A two-hour SportsCenter is next at 5. The PTI guys are along at 5:30, and cap it all off with SportsCenter with SVP. A full day of sports right here on ESPN.